everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest, freelance designer and writer for Fail Better Games, who's currently working on his own game below, Chris Gardner.
Hello there.
Hey, Chris. So, how is everyone's week going so far?
Yeah, pretty good here so far. So covered in sick children, which happens whenever I'm trying to get lots of work done. So, but other than that, we're good.
And I'm just trying to get, you know, healthy from a sickness I just had a couple weeks ago. So, there you go.
I'm doing reasonably okay health-wise for once. I've been doing a lot of extra typing lately, so my arms have been sore, so I've been easing off that. But knock on wood, I haven't gotten sick or anything yet. But with the whole weather weirdness going on right now, it's like 80 degrees in October. Who knows how long that will last?
Maybe we should look into text-to-speech or speech-to-text programs. Yeah. I remember them back in the 90s. When I was a kid, I was like, maybe I can use this instead of having to type my own reports. It would never work. It would always be like the most asinine like translation of what I said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard a lot of like annoying things like you have to basically train it to your voice before you can even use it.
The only it's time depressing because fingers are so last century.
True.
Maybe we'll get to the point where you just like mentally just reads our minds, Matrix style, we check in.
I saw a few weeks ago, I went to the university in Nottingham, which is the city I live by, and saw a 8-year-old boy sitting in front of Skyrim with a weird headset on, making rocks levitate with his mind. So
I think that's called minutes away. I think I know what that is. Emotive? It's a type of, it's like a commercial EEG device.
Yeah, I saw someone like that when I was at one of the IGDA Philadelphia meetings, like 3-4 years ago. Mm. It measures, I think, the blood pressure in your brain, sort of like when you're thinking to move something up, it measures that, and then it corresponds that to the motion on screen.
I don't think it's blood pressure per se. There's two ways that they have it. Because I actually did research at my master's for this, actually. So is EEG, mm-hmm. or it's a spectroscopy, which is like light probing. So it's either one of those things. But if it's IGDA, it might have been FNIR, which is the spectroscopy stuff. So pretty much what happens is, it sounds really scary, by the way, they project light into your frontal lobe. So they put this thing on your forehead, so, and they shine light into your head, right? But when you think, right, you have a higher level of hemoglobin, and they have oxygen obviously combined with it. So light gets reflected or retracted in a certain way, giving them a reading, and they use that as a type of control for various things you can do, like moving your character around or moving something up and down, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot better in EEG in terms of not being too invasive, because EEG devices, you have to like put like a skin cap and like gel on it.
Yeah, gunk on your head, yeah.
But this one's just like a little like pad on your head.
So I guess, are we moving now towards like Videodrome with that giant thing on your head?
Well, there's actually been a Kickstarter for the emotive device that I talked about earlier. So I guess they're trying to promote that. It's like, this is going to be the future. You can control like helicopters and stuff with your brain. I'm like, no way. I know for a fact that could not happen. Like their little promo video was insane about what they could do. I'm like, listen, just a minor distraction will make your plane destroy itself. Like, yeah. Oh, look, a pencil. Oh God, I destroyed like $100 million helicopter.
They'll just like spin all of a sudden out of control. Yeah, I think with the, I know like with back what they were doing in Philadelphia at the time, it was like still very early. I mean, this was like 4 or 5 years ago. So I don't know if they went any further with that device, and that's what you're talking about now, Ken, or if this is just an entirely new version of it.
They probably used, there's two consumer devices that came out in the market. Emotive was like the complicated, expensive one, and there was another one called NeuroSky, which is actually using a lot of toys now. Like, you ever watch, you ever see the lightsaber or Jedi training game?
Yeah, I think I've heard of it.
Like, it's, have like a little tube with a ball and it goes up and down, right? That's NeuroSky's technology. The thing is that it's easy to have like an off and on, like two points of values, because it's just like one sensor on your forehead. But the Emotive's device, the expensive one, has like 16, which has a much better sense of control, but still not nearly enough to do all the things they claim.
Yeah, I know Google is experimenting with this device for cars, and they attach to the car, and then you basically let the car drive itself. It has like the motion scanner on top.
This is horrible. Because I did so much research in this. Let me just tell you now, after like 60 years of research in neuroscience, like what we still don't know what any parts of the brain really does. It's all just infer, like maybe this happens, maybe this happens. But we don't really know. So having a form of control like that, to be that precise, is not possible right now, at least at our current tech.
Now, with the Google thing, it's not by humans. Basically, they program the motion sensor, like a computer will basically drive the car for you. But I know a lot of people who are just a little scared of letting, you know, all that control go to the automated program.
Well, I don't know. I believe more in a computer program than people on the road, honestly. But hey, Chris, what do you think about brain devices as the future controllers for games?
I think that's it's going to be a long time until they've got the the kind of fine control that an analog stick does. I think the unless you're getting really invasive, you can only get quite broad readings from the human brain at the moment, I think. So something as sophisticated as your average, you know, Xbox controller, which has like, I'm just looking now, what, like 13 different points of kind of contact and different buttons and levers and twiddly bits and stuff, I think it's going to be a good while.
Well, I think it has to be combined with something, you know, similar to how Kinect can be combined with something. So I think that would be the only way. But at least we're making steps towards that. Give it 20 years, we'll be like, it's going to be like Neuromancer in here. Have all these attached devices.
You don't need these annoying thumbs anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs that? That's craziness. That's for apes.
We'll all have our cyber augmentations from Deus Ex at that point.
Well, you know, they are doing research on, you know, how you increase your memory? They actually did an experiment with animals where you can attach like a memory chip to extend their memory, which is would be awesome.
I'm not plugging anything into my head.
Don't you? But you could like load different languages. You should be traveling to China, put in your Chinese chip, and be completely fluent. Wouldn't that be awesome?
And nothing is going in my head.
So now we're heading towards like what they're doing with that Remember Me game. Then.
Oh, that! What a tragedy that game was. I love that art style, and the music was so good. It just got bogged down by that horrible fighting system. Have you guys tried Remember Me?
I've just read the reviews of it.
I mean, I think they drummed up a lot of controversy for their game by saying, like, they didn't want a female protagonist. But I think their audience wasn't really going to have a problem with that. I just think that their problem was the battle system. It was very...
And they said it was bloated. Overly linear, too, I heard. Like, you just follow an orange line around.
Right. They should have went, like, the Assassin's Creed route with it. But the memory sections of it, it was really cool. Did you read about that?
I've read, but I don't know too much about it.
It's actually... And we'll probably talk about it later in storytelling, but the way it works is you have to remix people's memories and make them think something else happened instead of what actually happened. And so you kind of scrub through a timeline so you can see like the beginning and the setup and then what happened at the end. And then you can go between the timeline and scrub through and then alter, like change different things around the environment to make different events happen and to your liking, which is a really cool idea.
Sounds sort of like a more advanced version of the plot behind To the Moon, actually.
Oh, I was thinking about Ghost Trick. But
was it like a 3D kind of action adventure?
Yeah, it was. Oh. It was a third person game, third person platformer. Oh. But the memory mix was the best part of that game for sure. It just there was only four of them though, so it wasn't really like they should just made that the game and made the rest just exploration. That would have been great, but they didn't. They had to put in the fighting system and had to give really stupid names for the combos and stuff. I'm not saying it was stupid, but it wasn't easily translatable, you know?
Okay, so. There wasn't a lot of news this week to really talk about. I know last week we talked a lot about the Steam Box and all that, and this week news has just dried up. But I did find an interesting piece from GameSpot. So what happened was they decided to re-review, or they had someone else review BioShock Infinite now. And the game came out, what was that, like 6-7 months ago?
Yeah.
Yep, so they had another take on it, and this guy basically gave it, what was it, like a, he gave it like a, oh, here it is, a 4 out of 10. And as you could probably guess, a lot of the fans weren't exactly happy about it. Yeah. And this brings up another interesting trend that's been happening lately is the idea of re-reviewing games. Normally, when we talk about games that get a second or even a third review, that used to be for MMOs. I know Star Wars, the first MMO, I forget the full name of it, that had a multiple review. When they released their whole like completely revised game, they did a second one of them.
The Galaxies.
Yeah, and then now with as more games became more digital distributed, and we're seeing them being updated and patched, there's this idea of having to keep reviewing games. Probably the big example recent would be SimCity 5. And the website I did was Polygon. When they first came out, or like a day or two before release, they gave it a 9 out of 10. And then it slowly but surely trickled down. So then they re-reviewed it, became a 7. They did it again, then it became a 4. Then it became like a 2. And then, interestingly, it went back up to like a 4. And I don't know where it's at right now.
So it's a liquid number.
Live reviewing.
Exactly.
So, for both of you, what do you think of this practice? Do you think that we should be allowed to re-review games, or do you think it should be just a one-and-done type of deal?
Feels weird to re-review something like Bioshock Infinite, which hasn't changed significantly since it was released. Something like an MMO, you know, a review of what World of Warcraft was like at launch is not reviewing the same products as the Warcraft that's available now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Eurogame, we've got a system of re-reviewing MMOs after sort of 6 to 12 months because it takes so long to play through them and you don't get a great impression of what an MMO is like until you've kind of played all through to the end game, and then after the first few patches, it's normally a radically different experience anyway. I think that makes a lot of sense. I do wonder how Metacritic handle this, because Metacritic's so ingrained into the business of game making now, and people's, you know, bonuses depend on it, and their future employment depends on it. Whether they get future contracts and stuff depends on what the average Metacritic score of their games has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's more reports being told that even Metacritic's about the bonuses as well. The game doesn't get like 80 or plus, you don't get your bonus for making the game.
I guess that's
so. What happens with the SimCity game when they, you know, if they had that polygon review dropping it to 2, what does that do to you? Do they then take the bonus back? What? How would that even work? I don't know. And I mean, that's not the problem, the fault of the review site. That's the problem with how game publishers use Metacritic, which is a complicated and problematic thing.
There's definitely people out there that review games just for shock values and give it like really crazy low scores. Some of it's valid and some of it's not. But they still bring down the Metacritic score pretty low. But if you think about it, like the way that people perceive scores anyways now is like if it's below 8, it's mediocre. If below 7, it's terrible. Yeah. So it's pretty much already at five stars already. You know, we don't really need like a 1 to 10 scale at all, if you think about it.
Yeah.
People don't even bother if it's below 7.
Mm. That's definitely one of the issues I saw with Core to 3 with Tom Chick. He uses the 1 to 5 star rating pretty much rigidly. If a game is bad, he will give it a 1 or 2 star. There's no, you know, it's an okay game, you know, I hate it, but I'm going to give it 4 stars. He's like, if this game, if I don't like it, it's getting a 1 star, and that's, you know, going to be on Metacritic.
And I think he's got a very, I think Tom is one of the best reviewers in the business. And whenever I read a review by Tom, I can almost always tell if I'm going to enjoy the game, regardless of whether he's kind of recommending it or damning it. He conveys, you know, his impression and opinion of the game so clearly. It gives, whether he likes it or not, I've got a good idea if I should get the game or not. But he reviews very much based on his reaction and response to the game, and is completely open about saying that's the only way you can review something. Yeah. If you're claiming that you're reviewing it based on something else, you're probably kidding yourself. There's no objective measures here. There's no kind of consistent way to weigh up having good sound against having good graphics or having good story and to combine that into a perfect score. Mm-hmm. All reviews are subjective.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's not how Metacritic treats them, or more specifically, it's not how the publishers that use Metacritic data treat them.
And I think developers are really obsessed with it too, Metacritic, because again, if when Steam had the big Metacritic score on, I think they still do, right? Big Metacritic score on their page, when it goes really low, that game gets crushed. It gets forgotten and crushed really hard because of that score.
Yep, and about being subjective, that's why I don't really assign scores to the games that I review for Game Wisdom, because when I look at gameplay, even though that is somewhat objective-based, it's still pretty much my impression. I can try and make it as unbiased as possible, but by the end of the day, it's based on how I perceive the game.
Mm-hmm.
And just being gameplay-wise, I don't even want to try to think about how I would give a score to, you know, is this game, you know, the platforming must be really good here. This must get a 7. or this shooting doesn't seem right. Let's give it a 1. That'll just be a whole new nightmare to deal with.
Yeah, I remember we had a big debate about gameplay versus aesthetics in experience for a while in a previous podcast about Bioshock Infinite specifically. So. Yeah.
And we got into our little argument at 3 o'clock in the morning, too, before that, which was good.
We should have recorded that instead. It felt like unfresh after we did the cast. Mm-hmm.
But with Bioshock Infinite, as we said, going back to post another review now does seem, as Chris said, seems like somewhat of a low blow. I mean, if they change, if they release, 10 different content patches, that would be a different story. But it just seems kind of weird to do it now, just out of the blue.
No, it's definitely they're trying to do clickbait. That's what it is. They want more clicks for their site. They want to be controversial to get more views for the site. I mean, everyone does it to a degree. People are talking hyperbole for that reason alone, just to get more hits for more money for their advertisers.
So what So what you're telling me is that I should do Bioshock Infinite and just call the worst game of all time.
Yes.
Horrible. You should throw in a fire, never play again, and just send that out to people.
Yeah, do that, and then put a bunch of ads everywhere. Done.
Awesome.
Millions of views. but you need to have like a strong name behind it too. You can't just be a random person be like, this is the worst game ever, and then it wouldn't mean anything. But I think it's on the main subject. I don't think it's fair for them to review Bioshock because it isn't an online game. I think online games definitely should have that ability to be re-reviewed because again, patches will change a game. Like look at like the Arkane games, right? Mm-hmm. Look at Skyward Collapse. Like that game really changed from what it was to what it is now.
Yeah, that's
it's still good, but just a different kind of game, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty much Arkane's MO with a lot of the games mm-hmm. they support is mm-hmm. they just keep enhancing, they keep building up. Like with Shattered Haven, because they had plans for it, but because it didn't sell well, they sort of let that one lay to rest, so to speak. But because Skyward Collapse took off, they support that heavily. And even with my analysis of it, a lot of it pretty much is no longer applicable because they changed so much even without the expansion. They've redefined the resource system. They've added new abilities. So it is a fundamentally different game from 1.0 to, I guess it's considered 2.0 right now.
I think it's good to go back kind of in the... after the sparkle's worn off, to kind of go back and re-examine a game after a few months when the initial kind of frenzy's done and everything. That's valuable, I think, and you can get all sorts of interesting stuff out of that. What is weird is putting a review score on the end of it and treating it as a review. And what are reviews for? Because are they partly the sort of a consumer service? That would kind of be the point of them coming out as soon as possible with the release of the game. But Bioshock Infinite's been out for months now. People still kind of are there hordes of people havering over whether to buy it on Steam that are going to go, oh, no, actually, the score's 4 now. I won't bother. I don't know. It's just, I think as an article that goes back and reexamines the game, brilliant. Calling it a review and putting on a score at the end seems really, really strange.
No, that is straight up from the editor. The editor was like, we needed some more views. Let's something super controversial.
It is very possible the writer did not put a score on this. That's true. Yeah.
Just like, yeah.
Now, incidentally, as we talked about Tom Chick a few minutes ago, one of my favorite reviews from him that he actually did a re-review of was Supreme Commander 2. And this was a few years ago. What happened was when the game was released, it had a horrible AI. The multiplayer wasn't working, and I think he gave it like a 2 or 3 out of 10. He called, most disappointing game, hated, and everything was said and done. And then over the months, Gas Powered Games, they completely redid the AI system. They hired a modder called Soren, who's actually now working on Planetary Annihilation. He basically did a complete rewrite of the AI system, making it, I think it's considered one of the best skirmish AIs in any strategy game. And then Tom basically re-reviewed it. I think he gave like a 7 or 8 out of 10, saying, they proved me wrong. It's now a great game.
5-star system now, so it's probably 5, right?
No, this was when it was on, when 1UP was still around. So 1UP used the 1 out of 10 system.
Okay.
So that was an example where a re-review was not only warranted, but it changed a lot of the perceptions of people who were playing it. I mean, I didn't even pick it up at start because of that review, and then after I heard that, a lot of my friends said, now's the time to check it out, I got a much better game that I wouldn't have known about otherwise. Mm.
And that's after the people who made the game have obviously kind of listened to the response and then gone to great lengths to fix it.
Yep, exactly.
It's good to recognize that. Again, it's a case of the game not being the same product it was on release.
I think Rome 2 will probably do the same kind of thing. Because their biggest complaint with that game is, you know, that AI. So I'm sure they'll probably patch it up and it'll be a different game, you know, 4 months from now.
That'll be interesting.
And now that actually raises another question. For both of you, do you think when we see these examples of games that are released at start and they're horrible, you know, not finished, buggy, et cetera, and then they get fixed along the way, do you think that kind of mentality should be rewarded? Like, should we praise them for doing that, or should it just be like, it's kind of like their job, so to speak?
For me, I think it's good. It's commitment to a product. And, for example, Final Fantasy XIV. It's ranked probably the worst, to me, personally, the worst game launch in history, using my own hyperbole. Like, it's so bad that I would like to teach classes about it at universities, about how not to launch a game. And that's exactly what that game is. But they powered through it because they had a really strong brand, and they knew it was really important for the fans and to keep their base, and keep save face from such a horrible mistake. And they completely destroyed the world and made a new game called Final Fantasy XIV Reborn. And that's been reviewing very well. Because they actually bring in, you know, new techniques that MMOs use now, you know?
Got rid of the old design team, right? And they brought a completely new one on?
Yeah, and a new director and everything. Exactly. I mean, I can just give you some quick examples of why it's bad, just because I want to say it again, because I always like to do it. Like, example. You know how games have marketplaces?
Mm-hmm.
In that game, you have to physically find a person, look through their inventory, and buy something.
Wow.
No fast travel. No mounts. You have to walk everywhere. All the environments. You know, like how people use landmarks to figure out where they are in the world and in games? None of that in this game. Just they made the world vast, right? Mm-hmm. But full of nothing. Just nothing. Just like round planes with curves. You're like, oh, well, it's a hill. There's another hill. It's exactly like that one.
Good.
Okay, I guess it takes about 20 minutes to run from one place to another.
Oh my god, when I talk with Jason about open world games, like the sandbox games, that's what kills me in a lot of those open world games. I hate that, you know, just push forward and do nothing for 20 minutes until I get to the next mission. So that would just be it for me. I think that would make me, like, take that disc and smash it or something.
Oh, yeah? Well, how about this? When you die in an MMO or a game, what usually happens?
Of course, you respawn somewhere. You start back at home base or something.
Okay, well, in Final Fantasy XIV, you get no prompt of what to do. And then you get a message in your box saying, you killed you.
Nice.
You killed you. And so when I played, I had to keep making new characters. New characters, because I couldn't figure out how to revive the other character. And you can't speak when you're dead, right?
Well,
so you're just stuck with no one to talk to. And this is in the beta. 2 weeks, by the way. They only had a beta for 2 weeks.
Ugh.
2 week beta. Isn't that crazy? 2 week beta for an MMO? People have, like, look at Path of Exile. They have, like, a 6 year beta, all right?
Yeah, it's finally coming out now. I think it's actually going to be released at the end of this month.
I don't know what they were thinking with a 2 week beta like that and with all these gigantic problems like that. And, by the way, it was like, okay, you actually go in the menu. It's, like, buried in the menu. It's, like, in the sound menu. It was like, return. That's how you revive yourself. It was just buried. There's no way you could find out. The help didn't give you any sort of information about how to actually do that. And even internet forums online couldn't figure it out either. I'm like, wow, that's the most unintuitive design I've ever encountered in my life.
Yeah, it was probably...
So anyways, I'll stop railing against this. But again, Final Fantasy XIV Realm Reborn fixed all these issues. They put new mounts. They made them much faster. They made the combat more, you know, enticing. They put in a marketplace. They listened to everyone and they fixed all the problems. And I think that even though they're taking such a huge loss, I think they're doing it service because it is an important product to them and they do care about their fans. Similar to, you know, like you, Chris, if you had a huge rally of hate for one of your games, you would go back and revisit it, try to fix it up the best you can.
Yeah, and I think regarding sort of whether it's just their job to get it right at release, there's so much that goes into game publishing, especially kind of traditional game publishing, that we never really know what the circumstances surrounding a game's release were, and to what extent the people that the developers want it released at that point, to what extent they're being kind of pushed into it, or what complicated the development or whatever. So I'm always reluctant to sort of say, no, it's just their job to get it right from the get-go, because I don't think it's always possible. And sometimes if a game's a bit experimental, it can be very hard to work out how it's going to be received when it hits a kind of wider audience and stuff. So I think if people keep working on it after it's released and polishing it, that's only a good thing. Like you said, it shows dedication to the product, and respect for the people that invested in it.
Yeah.
I'd certainly rather that than I end up with a crappy game that I never play.
Yeah, forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'll have the scars that I had with 14.
Yeah.
I'm traumatized for life with that game.
Yeah.
It's like one of those podcast things. I always bring it up whenever I can. I'll just talk about it for like 5 minutes. It's
still part of forever.
Yeah, I know my quick example would probably be Elemental by Stardock. When that game was released, as you said, Chris, a lot of people don't know the circumstances behind when a game was released. You know, was that really the version they want to put out? And Elemental is a good example of that. What happened was, it was supposed to be released on a Monday, and the stores broke the street day and they released it on Friday. And Stardock's whole plan was to do a big day one patch to basically fix a lot of the game or take it from end of beta to retail. So what happened was all these people got the game a few days early, and lo and behold, they're basically playing the unfinished beta version of the game as their $50 or $60 retail release. So what happened was, in response, they basically did an emergency patch that barely fixed the issue. So when the reviews came out, everyone was reviewing the day 0.5 version of the game. And even when I played, it was horrible, and it just set the game back like a few weeks, even like a month, before they started really get in and fix some of those issues. But even with that said, they're up to two or three like expansions, Elemental, standalone expansion, and it's finally getting to the point that I'm hearing that there's actually a complete game now.
Didn't people who bought Elemental get the next game free?
They got, Yeah, I was one of those people.
Fallen Enchantress.
Yeah, we get...
Which is great.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Anyone who bought up a full release got, I think, up to two of their expansions. So I think they just released a new one a few months ago that I haven't tried out. But I got them both for free, but I've just been so busy I haven't had a chance to really get in and try them again. So I think getting on from a little bit of news and talk about a few games that we've been playing. Now, I know, Ken, you have a game that sort of fits with our storytelling topic that we're going to talk about soon.
Yes, called Gone Home by Fulbright Company. That's what they're called, right?
I really don't know. I haven't followed that game too much.
Yeah. I know the company's called Fulbright, but I don't know the other tags. The game company, is it? You know what I mean?
Fulbright, yeah, Fulbright.
So, yeah, but there's a really great game about, it's pretty much a story told through exploration of the environment, and it's it really gives you an in-depth, you control how you pace the narrative yourself by the way that you interact with the environment around you, by looking at, you know, papers or, you know, what's in boxes, and there's a lot of items within the house that you're in that has no actual purpose. They're just there because they're there, just like in real life, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really unique game, and I was really excited for that game to come out. And I'm going to be really excited when they give Oculus Rift support for it.
Yeah, right.
But for anyone that doesn't know the game, Gone Home is about this girl who's been traveling through Europe, and she comes home, and there's no one there, and the door's locked, and there's a weird note on the door, and she can't find her family. And you have to explore this very, very large, little creepy house, and you get random messages throughout the game as you explore and find out more about your sister. So it's, I don't want to ruin anything about it, but it's definitely a great game to experience because it's a game that's scary that's not scary at all. So
now, I've heard the big criticism about a game that is short, right? It's only like 3-4 hours.
Yes, maybe even two. So that's the biggest problem with the game. It is very short, but again, it's a game you shouldn't power through. It's a game that you should, like, you know, invest in and give it time and let things sink in and, you know, analyze it. Like a fine wine, you know, let it. So it's definitely a unique game that's come out, at least in the indie scene.
Now, in terms of actual game mechanics, what the player does, I heard it's similar to Dear Esther, right? That you're mainly just moving around, you can pick up objects, but there's no, like, puzzles or any type of situations for you to solve?
There is a kind of like a puzzle. It's a really, really rudimentary puzzle, but, like, the certain things unlock when you get certain points or certain letters. And that's pretty much the puzzly parts of it. But again, when I played the first time and I watched a friend play through it, we took completely different routes. In fact, he found a bunch of hidden things I didn't even know existed. And I thought I explored the thing up top down, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of things they put into it. And in fact, actually, one of the things that actually hooked me to the game, it was really silly, but in one of their developer blogs, they had a video of the most interactive refrigerator ever. and they showed, you know, like with a cup, and they could put water in it and ice, and you can open it and turn lights off and on. Like, okay, cool. I'm buying this game.
Yeah.
But if you guys haven't tried it, it's definitely a great experience. And if they ever do Oculus Rift support, that's one of the games that would marry it the best.
Now, I heard they are doing, I think they're doing like a content patch or an update to it soon. I think it was posted on the Core to 3 a few days ago.
I have no idea anything about that.
Let's see. While I'm bringing that up, it also reminds me a little bit of a game that I just tried yesterday, the Stanley Parable.
Oh, yeah, that'd be probably not quite similar. That's probably more similar to Dear Esther.
Yeah, and I've been playing it. What they're doing is it's a demo, but it's not really a demo. It's basically an entirely original scenario just to give you an idea of what the actual game's about. And, of course, even after playing, I still don't know what's going to actually happen in the full game. But it does have that interesting idea, as we're going to bring this into storytelling in a little bit, that it's really just about your interactions with the world or your partial interactions, because your mechanics are pretty much limited to move and just like hit a button or something. But it's interesting how, as you said, that two different people can play a game that has such limited mechanics, but have completely different paths through it.
And completely different interpretations of things, too, based on what they've read.
Chris, have you played like any, like, I guess we should maybe save this for later, but have you played any like narrative-focused games lately?
I'm trying to think what the last kind of strongly story-driven game I played was. It's been a little while. Because I'm writing one, I'm trying to kind of, I'm playing other stuff with my time. But I was just looking at Gone Home, and I'm intrigued that what they call it, when they describe it, is a story exploration video game. And story exploration is interesting and fits with what you were saying about different people being able to get kind of completely different experiences from it because they've gone about it in a different way. And things like Gone Home and Dear Esther sort of work by the storytelling is mostly environmental. It's in the environment you're exploring. It's not kind of conveyed through events given in cutscenes or even events given in gameplay. And you're sort of reconstituting a story as you play, which is a very different approach to the way most AAA games do it, where they've got a story that they want to tell you, and then you get to play when they're not telling you their story.
Yeah, and that's definitely something we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. Oh, I just found what I was looking at. It was actually on Polygon. It's not a content update. It's going to get commentary tracks, and it'll be a free update.
Oh, great.
Huh.
I love commentary tracks.
Yeah, who did we have on that said that he would love to have more games with it, I think.
It's Chris, right?
I think it was one of the guys from Clay. I think when we talked to the Mark of the Ninja developer.
Ah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but yeah, commentary tracks are really an interesting thing. As we said in the last cast, pretty much Valve seems to be like the only studio that does it most of the time.
And I think, you know, we're in the kind of age where developers and their fans are, you know, getting ever closer through all their social media and the way they communicate with each other. So, you know, I'm sure that fans would love commentary. Because, I mean, that's why people love movie commentary, too. They want to get insight on what the director was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, especially what the team's thinking. Go ahead.
Yeah, especially for games like Gone Home, where people get so invested in the story. All the kind of responses I've read to Gone Home have been really emotional. People have been very affected by it, and that's the sort of thing where you want to hear kind of what the creators were getting at, how they managed to kind of pull that off.
Well,
the Left 4 Dead commentary tracks are really interesting. They're really good.
Yeah.
That's just on Gone Home, by the way. I think it has some of the best voice acting I've ever heard in a game. Really gave really good performances in that game. I really like it. Of the voices that of the little voices that exist, you really feel for the characters. I really like
if
it.
You haven't played the Stanley Parable demo yet. The narrator has a really good voice. I was cracking up a few times playing it yesterday.
It sounds like a storybook narration, right?
Yeah and no. It's one of those games that it's hard to really explain it without giving it away, and I still haven't quite figured it out yet.
Is it British and snarky?
A little bit.
So I
like those things go together.
Right. I don't even need to say a second part.
Moving on from Gone Home, the game that I want to talk about that I played a little bit on off this week is Knock Knock. And this is from developer Ice Pig Lodge. Have either of you heard of them before?
No.
Ken?
Nope.
Yeah, they're not a huge company. I think they're based in Russia, and they've only released 3 games so far. The first one was Pathologic, I think, or something like that. And then the second one was The Void. And then, of course, Knock Knock. And their style, which fits well with what we're going to talk about storytelling, is they focus on narrative and experience pretty much at the top of their list. And then gameplay is usually like a distant third or fourth. They don't really do too much with gameplay. And instead, they pretty much follow this idea that you shouldn't be told what the gameplay is. There's no tutorials. Most of the games, I know The Void and Knock Knock, neither of them have what could be considered a manual. What you get is basically like a 2-minute press W to move forward, press space to interact, and then that's it. They basically just let you go off and either succeed or fail repeatedly until you get it right. And Knock Knock is just like that. It's a game that has a really amazing aesthetic to it. I think I posted some screenshots. Have either of you looked at the screenshots or the videos for it?
Yeah.
Not yet.
It's got like this great, like a European, like fairy tale type aesthetic to it. Like, it has like this very disturbing look, but it's clean. And
yeah, and quite kind of exaggerated. I hate the word cartoony. I'm trying to find a better one. But it's got a touch of kind of Disney animation to some of it. But yeah, still got that kind of the weirdness of European animation.
Oh yeah, I think I actually have seen this game, the screenshots for it and such. It is kind of reminiscent of like a little bit Burton-ish, you know what
I
mean?
Tim Burton. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like American McGee, kind of that kind of going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you need in some distortions are even almost like Eastern European films from the 1930s kind of thing as an influence, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just love how completely unique the main character is. Like, he looks like nothing you would see in a traditional video game or even like a mainstream video game. He looks more like a minion or a bad guy to me.
Yeah, yeah. Or he looks really angry.
Or a disturbed character would be another one, I would say. Right.
Yeah.
So the idea of the game is that you're stuck in a house. I'm not going to spoil the story because I don't quite get it either, but general gameplay is that you're stuck in a home or cabin that is randomized each night. And your mission is you have to stay awake until dawn. And to do that, you have to go around and fix all the lights. And at random times during the night, the power will get knocked out in a specific room. And if you're not quick enough, a creature or something will basically enter your world and will start coming after you. And if you get touched by them or you interact with them, you basically time rewinds. And so the whole game, someone sort of compared it to like a pseudo tower defense type situation, because you're basically going around and you're just trying to keep things from getting out of hand. Because once you fall down that slippery slope of you're not repairing lights, you know, the whole place is dark around you, you're pretty much on your way to getting a restart. So the problem that I have with the game is that there are a lot of rules to the game of how you're supposed to hide. There's something about how you should turn the lights on, but you should actually turn them off when you're not in the room. But then if you do that, something else happens. And your only clue as to what's going on is that the main guy, he will basically stop and just, like, utter, like, a random phrase while he's going around. That's supposed to be a hint to what you're supposed to be doing. But I just couldn't really figure out what the hell was going on. And I got, like, three stages in, and I just couldn't get past it. And it wasn't because the gameplay was so challenging. It was because of their style that I just didn't know what they were expecting me to do. And I know for a lot of people, they love that type of, you know, let get off the chain, you can do whatever you want. But I just found it more frustrating by the fact that I was failing, but I didn't know what I could do to improve myself.
Mm. This reminds me of two games I've played a chunk of recently. One is Don't Starve, which has a similar kind of system of dropping you in this world, and then you discover the rules of the world by playing with it. It sounds like the rules in Don't Starve are more straightforward than the rules in Knock Knock. But there's still the case where you never know if you've missed a rule or, you know, when you're making items, what you should expect an item to do.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I know when I first started playing Don't Starve, I didn't know how to get charcoal or ash, I think.
Mm-hmm.
and I eventually had to look up a hentai. But then that raises the issue of, especially with a game like Knock Knock and Don't Starve, once you're sort of told how the mechanics work, how the gameplay interactions are, the game loses most, if not all, of its mystique.
That's it. And when you go to a wiki page or something about the game, it's very hard to just get the bit of information you're looking for and not spoil all the rest. The other game this is a bit like is Dark Souls. And I love both Don't Starve and Dark Souls. Dark Souls is probably my favorite game of all time. But I've to work out how to kind of upgrade my equipment and what all the numbers and stuff on my equipment mean, I had to go to a Dark Souls wiki and to work out some stuff about how multiplayer works and things as well. And there's lots of stuff in Dark Souls that people still aren't sure how it works, how you get humanity for leaving a message, for example. People still see the details of it are still pretty hazy, and it's hard to tell what's game mechanic and what's the servers being weird. And there's so much of Dark Souls depends on you playing in an exploratory fashion, and a lot of the story depends on that. And you're kind of looking at all the, most of the story is kind of buried in item descriptions, and the level layout and stuff. But, the upgrading your equipment in an RPG is not an optional activity. It's the only way you can beat the game. And, it's a huge part of the game mechanics and stuff. And having to go to a wiki really frustrated me, because inevitably it ends up spoiling bits of story and other stuff. And I end up finding out more than I want and all the rest of it. And I know when Dark Souls 2 was announced, there's this big outcry from Dark Souls fans saying, oh, they're dumbing it down. You know, they've got all this stuff about kind of making stuff clearer. But there is an ocean of possibility between having to go to a wiki page to read up about improving your items and having everything explained to you in a now press X manner. You know, there's no shortage of design space there that they could use. They could keep an exploratory, plenty of exploration in the game without having to drive people to fan-made kind of resources.
Yeah, and that is a really good point. I think it also has to deal with failure states and how I'm fine with losing a game if I know that I did something wrong or if I messed up. Like with Dark Souls, I mean, most of the time that you die is because you didn't dodge right or you try to block an attack that you couldn't really block. Yeah. But then when you have games that like Knock Knock or Don't Starve where you lose because you had no idea that I was supposed to prepare for winter, now winter came and I'm dead, or I didn't know that this plus this equaled a raincoat or something, now I died because of lightning or whatever. People find that a lot more frustrating when the failure is not because of what they did, but what the designers sort of, like, I guess, like, willed down on them.
I think there's quite a bit of that in Don't Starve, but at the same time, Don't Starve is all about that trial and error, and it's got kind of reincarnation built into its mechanics. And when you come back, you keep a load of stuff from before, don't you? You keep your research.
I think they may have edited that out. I think now, I know they did an update to the research system, but I don't think you actually keep any progression now. I think they just send you right back, but you do have that knowledge. But they have made it easier, I think, in terms of research. I think now there is no such thing as research points. Now it's whatever you build, once you build it, the first time you build it, it has to be at the machine or the science machine, and then all subsequent times you can build that same item wherever you want. So there's no longer like you have to scavenge for gold, you have to get enough research points to unlock a pitchfork, for example. Now another thing as we about failure and about whether or not it's where failure should be, we had a discussion before this cast about the adventure genre, and we were talking about Broken Sword. And the adventure genre is really interesting because as a lot of the classic adventure games, failure was completely arbitrary with a lot of them. I mean, I played the original King's Quest, and I basically took two steps out of the castle, fell into the water, and then I died. And as you were talking about with like the puzzles, a lot of the puzzles in old school adventure games were pretty much left to, you had no idea what you were supposed to do, and then that just brings a whole level of frustration.
And I think there's two things that kind of compound that. One is the fact that the failure consequence in an adventure game is you don't get to play the game anymore. You cannot progress beyond the point you're at until you solve the puzzle. And the other is that the longer adventure games got increasingly insular and reliant on their own vocabulary, and it became increasingly detached from a more kind of common vocabulary. And the puzzles got increasingly kind of ridiculous and obscure and relying on point-and-click mechanics and the idea that all the players had already done this dozens of times, which I think there's the amazing article on Old Man Murray about the Gabriel Knight 3 Mustache of Cat Hair puzzle.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Which is the puzzle that probably killed the point-and-click genre. And and it's such a terrible puzzle that I can't feel bad that the genre died after it. That once it had committed that atrocity upon its players, it was probably time for it to be put to bed for a little while until we can come back and be more responsible with it.
Can you tell us what it is without ruining anything?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm not worried about ruining, because it's not going to, like, ruin the story. and knowing the answer is only going to potentially improve someone's life. But it's a sequence where you're in a hotel. You've got your friend, who's a police officer, in the hotel, and you need to disguise yourself as him in order to get something from the hotel, from the desk at the hotel, I think. And so you have to steal his ID. It won't let you ask him for it or anything like that. You have to steal the ID from your friend. In order to do that, you have to, like, lay a trail of chocolate down to lead him down a corridor and then follow him down the corridor and pick his pocket. And then once you've got his ID, you have to draw a moustache on it in marker and then fashion a moustache from cat hair. And the only way you can get cat hair is by finding a hole in a fence, sticking sticky tape over it, and then scaring a cat so it runs through the hole, leaving its fur on the sticky tape, which you take off and stick to your upper lip as a completely convincing moustache. And only then can you kind of use his ID to get past the person at the front gate. So the whole thing relies on you disguising yourself using a mustache, even though the person you're trying to look like doesn't have a mustache. And you know, having no way to fake a mustache except luring a cat through a hole with sellotape. It's unbelievable. It's just, I'm simplifying some steps as well. There's more stuff in there which I've blanked out. I don't dare remember it. It was awful. Horrible thing.
Well, I'm glad you remember it in detail. It's how much it scarred you.
It left its marks, yeah.
But, you know, I would think like with the internet now, we could just patch it. We just have an option, like, ask friend for ID.
Yeah, that would be lovely. there's another point-and-click game that came out around a similar time called Mystery of the Druids. I was having a conversation about this on Twitter the other day, and I ended up reviewing it for Games Domain when it came out, and it was not a good point-and-click game. But the whole setup of the game is that you're a police officer. But the game played like a completely standard point-and-click game, a kind of late-era point-and-click game, which meant everyone was really arsey with you all the time and never did anything you asked them to, even though you were like a police officer or an FBI agent or something. You were someone in a position of authority. But when you were trying to do investigations, you were asking, like, what did you see that night? It would be like, well, I'm not telling you unless you bring a bottle of Chateau Neuf to Pap 1843 or whatever, you know, something ridiculous like that. And there's this whole bit where you had to call the police station and it decided that you didn't have a wallet and there was a payphone. And in order to call the police station, you had to steal a quarter from a beggar and put it in the payphone. It wouldn't let you go up to any of the passersby and say, can I borrow a quarter, please? Or anything. And that's just how adventure games ended up, I think. They just got so insular and kind of incestuous and self-obsessed that they stopped being relevant to anyone except obsessive adventure game players. And I was pretty obsessive, even though I put it on. Did you play Grim Fandango?
I played a little bit of it, but I never finished it.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. I mean, Grim Fandango is unquestionably an artistic triumph. The dialogue's amazing, the performances are brilliant, the artwork's beautiful. It's just stunning. It's incredible. But the puzzles are vile, and they're ridiculous. And the only way we could play it in the end, we were playing it with a group, and one of us volunteered to download a walkthrough and, like, man the walkthrough, sat at the back of the room with the walkthrough, and we would play the game. And when we hit a puzzle that we couldn't solve, he'd look at the walkthrough and he'd say, either, no, you can do this, just press on, or, and this happened most of the time, he'd say, there's no way you would get this unless you were a crazy person. And then he would tell us the solution and then we could proceed. But these are the strategies you had to come up with to get past adventure games. And it's not, I don't think it's because we were particularly unintelligent or anything. It's just, who has time to, to think, you know, if I stuck some sellotape to that hole and scared a cat through it, it would be the perfect way to make a fake mustache.
I just feel really stupid when I can't figure it out, actually. Even though it's asinine and ridiculous, I still feel real stupid. Like, man, why didn't I think of it?
fills me with fury. What is wrong with you people? If you went just, it's an easy test. If you go to someone on the street and say, here's the puzzle, here's the solution I'm proposing. If that person on the street slaps you or tries to get you committed, your puzzle is a bad puzzle. Change the puzzle.
That's why I think Walking Dead was so successful, because the people that were designing the game said, let's eliminate all this arbitrary stuff and think, what would we do in this situation? And I think the puzzle stuff was really like toned down. That's why I think it was so good, and why I was able to speak to a broader audience.
That's right. It's not so much about solving puzzles. It's about making difficult decisions for which there are no clear-cut answers.
Right.
Yeah.
Delusion of choice and everything too. But still, I still love that game though. But this is going to be a little weird question, but because you're such an adventure game enthusiast, and I think you have more experience than we do, what's your favorite adventure game?
Loom, which was an old LucasArts game.
Oh, yeah.
I think I bought that like on one of my mysterious Steam buying
sprees.
It's probably somewhere.
It's really, it's completely amazing. It was more amazing at the time because it scraped off all the kind of cruft that adventure games had accumulated. So it has no inventory system. You never pick anything up, which immediately removes the kind of ridiculous pack rat behavior of all adventure game heroes, where you have to pick up every paperclip and light bulb on the off chance. You'll have the chance to turn it into a improvised fishing hook to fish outside of the window of your canal to get a broken toy which has got batteries in that you'll need 3 hours later or something. It gets rid of all that stuff immediately, and it's a fantasy game, and it's got a very fairy tale feel to it, which immediately fits with the idea of arbitrary puzzles, because fairy tales are full of, you know, the witch requiring that you bring her, you know, a tear, a smile, and a moment of sorrow or something, but you don't solve those puzzles by combining bits of pieces of your inventory. You learn, you cast spells, and you cast spells. All spells are four notes of music forming a very short tune. And you learn them by finding them in the world. So, for example, you find the open spell by going to the beach, and if there's a seagull trying to tap open an oyster, and if you listen to its tapping, the notes of its tapping are the notes of the open spell. And then you can go and you can repeat these notes, and it'll open doors or open chests and stuff like that. And it's all about using the spells you've got on things in the environment. And it's there. All the puzzles are beautifully kind of logical and satisfying. It's impossible to get to a point and not have what you need. But they all require you to think and to understand how things will interact with each other. And it's just so satisfying. It's a really beautifully told story. It's not quite like, it doesn't feel like kind of traditional Tolkien fantasy or anything. It's really good. I think it would still, with if you manage your expectations on kind of appearance and length and stuff, I think it'd still hold up pretty well today.
Well, definitely. It's a business library. I probably have it too somewhere, so I'll give it a shot.
Really good. Really, really elegant design.
One of my favorite adventure games, I want to get your opinion on it, is Longest Journey. What did you
That's
think of that
great.
Game?
I really liked Longest Journey. That's the one where you have to manufacture it. Fishing hook to get a broken toy out of the canal, though. It's still got these kind of moments of
There's one that actually blocked me from finishing the game. I had to restart because I forgot to grab the monkey in my closet. I couldn't go back to the apartment.
Well, obviously, you know, I mean, what were you thinking leaving the house without the monkey?
I know, it's like without my monkey. Jeez, I should have brought Constable Monkey Face, whatever his name was.
Longest Journey had a great story. It was very unpredictable. It kept kind of widening the stage, and you kept going to these different worlds. It's massive conversation system, isn't it?
Huge
conversation tree, colossal. And admittedly, the first one you come across is probably the biggest in the game. But even none of them are small. Really amazing.
No, I think that's why I really love the game, is because of the conversations you would have. She was the first like real, like reasonable and intelligent and strong female characters I've ever encountered.
Yeah,
and I think that was, she's probably one of my favorite female protagonists of any game, Zippo Ryan. And they actually give it a good sense of the art style is really good too. Give it a sense of Stark and Arcadia. I really love it. And I think one of my favorite moments is just so random, but and also they downplay, they made a lot of things like subtle, right? Like the landlord was gay for one thing, right? But they didn't shove it in your face. It was just like undertones, and that's great. That's the way it should be done, right? Like how Walking Dead didn't like shove that Lee was the black. It was just like, this is part of life. Exactly. And that's why it's beautiful.
Yeah, it normalizes it rather than treating it as a thing to kind of point at.
Exactly. Yeah. As an extreme or a token or something like that. And I think one of your favorite dialogue is actually when you're trying to convince the cop to let you in. And the first thing you think about is using your feminine wiles. It's like, It's like, because like eventually it's like, no, I can't let you in. I can't let you do this. And eventually says, I'm a gay cop too. So it's not going to work on me. And I was like, this is hilarious. They thought that far ahead in the conversation tree to say something like that. And that's great. So, yeah.
It's got some great puzzles in as well. There's a section where you're in an alchemist's tower and you have to like finish off the alchemy spell he was working on.
Right.
Which is, and the way you solve it is, it's kind of trial and error and experimentation, but it's all very kind of logical and it's not arbitrary at all. There's lots of really good stuff. Yeah, I really, really like Fungus Chain.
The only problem with that was that super monkey, that dumb monkey in the closet. Come on.
There were just a few. It was as adventure games go, especially considering where it appeared on the cycle, I think Longest Journey was one of the least bad offenders. It just had like two or three really stupid puzzles in, and the rest
do the monkey now. Okay, but I mean, okay, just to scratch your head then, like there's a sequel, Dreamfall, to it. Mm. What did you think of that?
I didn't play it because it was more sort of 3D action adventure-y and stuff. And I think actually when it came out, I didn't have a computer that could run it. I think that was the main.
I guess it came out for the Xbox too. That was the problem with that game too, is because they made it for a console, so the point thing was kind of gone, and you had like a real like thing where you pointed at the controller. And that actually during the, and this is why I bring this up, is because recently there was a Kickstarter for Dreamfall.
Yes.
And that was the first Kickstarter project I put like tons of money into, because I loved Longest Journey so much. Mm. And they actually did a playthrough, like a commentary of all the games, Longest Journey into Dreamfall. I think, or just Dreamfall, either one, but it was really cool to see all the things that we would never have found out. Right from the get-go, he did something that I never thought was possible. I guess you could listen into someone's conversation. I'm like, what? Like, this is why commentary is so cool. And to get like a dev's idea of what they were doing when they're making the game.
Yeah,
especially, I mean, with a lot of indie games. Because one of the things that we've seen with Kickstarter and just crowdfunding in general is that we're getting a lot more knowledge about these developers. They're no longer these faceless names or just a name and a credit in a long list, like we see with like EA or a lot of major studios. But like as I talked about with John Schaefer a few weeks ago, now when you say, you know, this game sucks or I don't like this, with an independent developer, you can basically find that guy on the list and send him an email. But on the flip side, with commentary, as you said, you can pretty much get a lot more of the personality behind the developer and the design these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and like, who's the guy that did Dangerous Girls in high school?
That was Keith Nemitz. We had him on a few weeks ago.
Right. He actually engages his people on his forum, and actually directly, when people actually make these crazy insults, he actually goes on, actually talks to them, and tries to get their idea of it, which is a little crazy, but he does do it. And it's interesting how like starstruck the people are when they actually find it. Like, oh my god, the dev's talking to me directly. Oh jeez. That actually happened to me too, because I really love, are you talking about adventure games? You ever play a Blackwell Bundle, Blackwell Legacy?
No.
It's by name, I think it's Dave Gilbert, or Gibbert. From Wadget Eye Games. He made, he also made Resonance, no? Yes?
No.
Primordia?
No.
You should check it out. Let me just give you the premise, because I really, really, this is like my favorite independent adventure games of now. It's about this girl, whose aunt just died, and she finds out that she was being haunted by a ghost that now attached herself to her. And, he calls himself, you know, his name is Joey, and he's from like the 1920s, so he's like calling her Dollface, stuff like that, and, I guess he's kind of like the legacy. That's why it's called Blackwell Legacy, because her last name is Blackwell. And he's attached herself to every single one after someone passes. And they kind of like solve paranormal crimes and trying to figure out the mystery of why they're even attached to begin with. And it's kind of like, it's really cool, because I really love the characters. It's like 1920s detective with Daria, Mission Accomplished. If you know Daria. Yes? No? Daria?
No.
No? It's an MTV show. The point is, a very snarky, sarcastic girl. She's like a writer, but you would really love it, because it is a little like rough around the edges for the first one, but as it goes on, it gets even sharper with the voice acting.
I'm just looking at this now. This looks great.
It is. It's really good.
I mean, Ken convinced me to play it, and I really did enjoy it too. I did, as you just said, Ken, the first game's a little with the puzzles. Mm. I mean, I got stuck on one, and I remember I was like, I'm stuck at this puzzle, I don't know what I'm doing. You're like, you're stuck in the dorm room, aren't you? I go, yeah. Like, you knew immediately what puzzle
there's one puzzle that's so crazy, because like, I guess there's like a notebook. You have to combine clues together, right? But it's not very clear that you have to do that kind of stuff, you know? It's one of those kind of things. But that's it. They fix that as it goes on. They eliminate things. So it gets better as it goes.
So you sort of use clues on each other.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
you have like a notebook. But it's a really cool, the dialogue between Joey and Rosangela, that's her name, which is an awesome name, by the way. I never heard of that name before. That Rosangela is really funny, because again, it's like someone that's really like overworked, sarcastic, and really what would you call it?
Down to earth, maybe?
I would say down to earth, but it's a term. I guess let's go sarcastic. It's good enough. Pessimistic. Yeah. So I really love that interaction, and they start to gel really well, and they actually jump around with the different Blackwell stuff too throughout the games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the one thing that we both agree that we didn't exactly like was the art style when they changed it in the third game.
Well, I actually asked the guy why he did that. Dave said that less money was coming through, which is why they instead of using the animated faces while they talk, they just had a still face. Mm. So that was why. I'm like, that's I mean, that makes sense, but I wish it was more fanciful of a reason. It's like, because this is the right design decision. I'm like, okay, cool. It was just a money issue.
Have you heard if they're going to do another game? Because they kind of left it with a pretty big to be continued.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end
a Blackwell Epiphany that's coming out, fifth one. They said he wanted to do it in fall, but he's been busy, so whatever. And he's been making other games too. He's become a publisher too. I think he made something called, what's Wizard of Oz? What's that place called? The Green Place.
Emerald
City Confidential. It was the first game he published.
Yeah, that was a while ago, thing.
Right. I don't know. I just love going in all these adventure games. I've been in a big adventure game kick ever since Walking Dead. That's brought me back into the fold. So I've been. We just made this podcast about adventure games. Should have done that.
All right. I think that's probably a good lead-in to talk about storytelling. One last note about Knock Knock is that just because I said that I didn't like it, that doesn't mean, for those of you listening, that you shouldn't play the game. Because one thing about Ice Pick Lodge is their games are just very polarizing. I know a lot of people who love The Void. I know some people who are saying Knock Knock is one of their best games this year. They just love the concept of it. But then, of course, there's people like me who just could not get into it. So yeah, if you're interested in it, look at screenshots of it, watch the little teaser trailer, and, you know, give it a shot if you're interested.